On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Yeah?
I think we need to have a little shout-out go to just recently our friends and neighbors here on the Heritage Radio Network. We had a little Heritage Radio Christmas party action in Brooklyn. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, got all the show hosts together in one place. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, Patrick was there, and Jack Hensley was there, and their whole little crew there. It was a lovely time in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
and,
very nice.
You know, I think that was really, I mean, we're the Jersey boys coming all the way in from Brooklyn for a party. We were the outliers. But, you know, it was fun to go back to Brooklyn. We talk about the Brooklyn of yore all the time, and that's Y-O-R-E, yore, all the time. And, you know, your grandmother, Catherine Lombardi, was from Brooklyn. I met her in Brooklyn, in the neighborhood in Brooklyn. Your goompa is still out there in Brooklyn.
Yep.
And, of course, we have a lot of friends in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a very cool place to be. But it was really nice to go out there with the folks from Heritage Radio Network, and then we went to an Italian restaurant.
Yep, we did.
And it was kind of interesting. It was a very good restaurant, and it was nice to be in the kind of the contemporary Italian, Brooklyn Italian restaurant.
Yeah, obviously very different than what we do. I mean, you and I have this kind of old school, old world Italian restaurant that was kind of emulated by the pizzeria and things like that for a long time. And we'll use the word, instead of emulated, we'll use bastardized.
Yeah, In many cases,
but. You know, Brooklyn's got a lot of cool new stuff going on, too. And obviously, Brooklyn's still got some of those old world restaurants, which are awesome, and I love them, and I still love to go to them. But there's a new world of restaurants out there in Brooklyn, too, serving, using some of the ideals and ideas from that past time, but kind of taking them to a more current level.
Well, and the other thing that's also interesting is, you know, there are restaurants that are more based in what's going on in Italy today, as opposed to Italian American. You know, it's funny how the world has changed. You know, it used to be when my ancestors emigrated over to the United States, and when your ancestors, French and Italian, emigrated to the United States, more the Italians, because you're Italian, you're more recently on the French side. But, you know, you got on a boat and you went to America, and it took 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then you got to America, and it was expensive, and you probably didn't go back. And if you did go back, you went back a couple of times. And there was no...
Well, sometimes you didn't go back because somebody was looking for you.
And that's the Italian side. No, and actually, that's the Irish side, too. I mean, you were fleeing political persecution, poverty. Mm-hmm. And also, you didn't have an iPad to send a picture. Your aunt in Naples didn't have an iPad to send
right,
a picture to your mom.
You weren't Facebooking with your mom. You talked to her every 7 years.
And now this was definitely Italian American cuisine using the best of local ingredients, but it also was very inspired by what's happening in Italy now and what's been happening in Italy for the past, you know, 15, 20 years, as opposed to, you know, that long history. And I thought that was just a very interesting take on it. It was fun for the...
Yeah, Brooklyn's cool again. I like that.
Yeah.
Brooklyn for a long time had really gone downhill and really, you know, had lost its
many
status.
Most neighborhoods, yeah.
Yeah, many neighborhoods. So obviously not. I'm talking in gross generalities now, right, as I have wanted to do. but Brooklyn, you know, in the 70s and 80s, it was not a awesome, you know, a lot of the neighborhoods were not great. And you're seeing a lot of those neighborhoods come back. You know, the restaurant we were in Brooklyn last night, or the bar we were in restaurant, a place called Tandem. You know, I was talking to the bartender. He's like, yeah, this street, we've been open for 2.5 years, and you know, since we've been open, they've closed down 7 crack houses and,
right.
you know, 4 restaurants and 3 bars have opened.
Yeah, you know, it's and, you know, it,
big differences.
And, you know, it goes neighborhood by neighborhood. There's Bushwick, which is turning over now, but I mean, Park mm-hmm. Slope turned over 15 years ago
right.
or so, and it's just, it's wild watching it happen. I have to say, in many ways, I find Brooklyn to be a lot more fun than Manhattan. And I find it to be a lot more diverse and interesting, and in many ways, there's nothing.
Well,
like
I am gonna say, you know, Manhattan is its own thing, and obviously is a great city. But some of the interesting is migrating into Brooklyn. There's just no doubt about
it. A ton
it.
Of it. I mean, well, you know, yeah. because if you're an artist or a performer or even want to open a restaurant and you don't have $5 million, you can't do it in Manhattan,
right?
And you can do it in Brooklyn. And you know, one of the things that I find about the city that's really changed is. I had an apartment in Second Avenue in St. Mark's for years, right? And when I did, the East Village was sort of just up and coming. Like, Soho had already arrived, and the East Village was starting to come, and the Lower East Side was still quite a dangerous place.
You know what that means, don't you?
Well, I'm old?
You're old.
Yeah, I know. Means. But, you know, I don't find the East Village as interesting now that it's arrived. And I remember when I had my apartment there, it was sort of in the crack years, and then afterwards.
You were doing crack back then?
No.
Sorry.
But, you know, it was in the Dinkins years, and it's that, down in, if you're not from around here in Manhattan, you have the police station down there on one block, and you have the Hell's Angels on the next block. And then the next block was a crack block, and then a heroin block was a couple of blocks up. And this was before the riots in Tompkins Square Park. And it was a fascinating place to live. And though there was danger that accompanied it, though when I came home from work in a suit, I took a cab to my door. But if I were wearing a leather jacket and a pair of jeans, I felt, you know, okay walking home. It was more interesting. The diversity was more interesting. I think a lot of that cultural diversity has moved
you
out.
You don't
to
think
Brooklyn.
It was just the adrenaline rush of the possibility of being mugged at any moment?
That added a little bit to it. But yeah. I just there was a more diverse cast of characters that actually lived in the neighborhood because you could afford it. You know, because they could afford it, and I think that's unfortunate. Well, we're going to take the conversation to another city now. We're going to talk with Sam McGannum. He has the Byright Market out in San Francisco. They're doing really incredible stuff. And he's written a book that's called Eat Good Food. Not the most creative title, but it gets
but
a point
a
across.
Great idea.
And it's a shopping guide and as well as a recipe guide. And he's a pretty interesting cat. We'll talk to him in just a moment on The Restaurant Guys. You're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Sam McGannum. He's the founder of the Byright family of businesses and stores out in California, in San Francisco. The Byright Market, if you haven't heard about it, is a really cool center of the community where you find a lot of local ingredients from small producers, exactly the kind of stuff we talk about. And his new book is Byright Markets Eat Good Food.
Hey, Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, I want you to, start out, Sam, by knowing you're at a little bit of a disadvantage here in New Jersey because there's a bunch of markets out here, a bunch of kind of...
liquor stores.
I don't want to say low-end, but discount liquor stores out here called Byright, spelled differently.
How do they spell it? Is it B-U-Y?
Yeah.
B-U-Y, where I used to go when I was 19 and... You
commit
know,
crimes.
Commit crimes.
Commit crimes.
Exactly.
You know, there's Byrights actually all over the country. When you know, we were considering trademarking the name at one point, and then realized there was, you know, no hope because they're scattered everywhere, and it's kind of a classic name from the 40s and 50s.
So
I think there's 3 in San Francisco.
Really? So you don't even have a right to the name. You don't own the name in San Francisco.
No. And, you know, it's all good. I love the fact that there's a few other businesses that are of that name, and it's just a point in time, a point in history.
Well, let's talk about Sam McGannum's Byright Market in San Francisco. What I mean, I have read your book, and we've been to San Francisco many times, haven't been to your store. Going to go next time we go because it sounds like what you're doing is really kind of off the hook, unique.
Yeah, we're trying. You know, I mean, we're trying to differentiate ourselves, but. But at the same time, we're trying to do the right thing, and you know, as a grocer, you know, I don't view myself as a peddler, and I think you know part of the issue with most grocery stores is that they're buying product. It doesn't matter what it is, putting a markup on it and selling it, and you know, so with the way so many supermarkets have gone these days, I mean, they could be selling shoes and spirits and produce and meat, and it's kind of all jumbled together, and
in some cases, they are selling all of those things in the same place, and.
Yeah, I know. It's exactly right. I mean, you've even got drugstores now. I mean, all the you know the Duane Reades and the Walgreens and the CVSs around the country are actually, you know, selling produce and dairy and soon they're going to be selling meat, and they're going head to head with each other. Targets in the food business, you know, and frankly, I think you know, Americans should be buying food from people that are passionate about food, people who care about the food, people who actually want to feed them well.
So what's for sale at the Buyright Market that you operate?
What's for sale?
Yeah, how do you select what to sell?
It's a full service market, you know. So, you know, I'm a you know, an ex cook, I'm a chef. And so when I first opened Buyright, I wanted it to be a cook store, and I wanted it a place where anybody who was trying to execute a recipe out of a book or out of a magazine could find all the ingredients that they needed. And so that was the basic premise. And you know, as a chef, I obviously knew that if you start with really good, flavorful ingredients, you're going to be able to end up with a much better product than if you start with swag. And so there was a focus on great tasting ingredients, and oftentimes those great tasting ingredients came from more local producers because they were fresher, and then they came also from organic growers who, you know, used heritage or heirloom breeds and seeds, and so that gave you a much, much more interesting product. And as we began to educate our guests, our customers about that, they got excited. You know, they began to experience flavors that they'd never experienced before. And in the process, we were teaching them how to use them, you know, kind of guiding them through the recipes, helping them make adjustments, teaching about seasonality. And so at any day in Buyright is different than the day before or the next day. And that's one of the things that I love about it. It's always a reflection of what's prime at that moment in time.
Cool. One of the things I read when I was reading your book, and it was early in your book, and it struck me right away. Said, I started using organic because it tasted better. And, you know, Francis and I have been talking about that for you know, as long as I can remember. You know, we started using these artisanally created products and these, you know, hand-grown, you know, farmer-driven products because they tasted better.
That's right.
And then as you did the research of what was going into those products that didn't taste as good, you kind of found out why they didn't taste as good.
I think for us, the philosophy came later. I mean, we began to understand food. It started out with a quest for simply the best tasting stuff to give our guests to differentiate ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we kept finding ourselves going back to, oh, there's a local farm. Oh, there's a little guy that makes that. Oh, here's a person. And what came first for you, the philosophy of how you wanted to buy food and making a difference in sourcing food for people? Or was it just that you were looking for good tasting stuff?
You know, honestly, what came first was this realization that as a cook, that I was developing an intimate relationship with the person that I was feeding, and I came to this realization after watching Babette's Feast, one of my favorite food movies of all time, and at the end, you know, Babette just spent all that money that she won in the lottery, and was, you know, poor again, and didn't care. All she cared about was the fact that she transformed the lives of the people that she got to feed. And I was 19 when I saw it, and I was like, this is it, man. I know what I want to do. And I was so excited about it. And so I've had that, that same drive, of knowing that, you know, that this relationship needed to be taken responsibly with, you know, between me as a cook and the people I was feeding. And so I wanted to feed them something that would excite them. And so flavor always was paramount. And oftentimes, with searching out for great flavorful foods, you're looking for produce or meats that are being raised by people that also care about that, and those end up more often than not being growers that are trying to do something that's humane or sustainable or organic. You know, they're searching out for a unique seed that's old and nobody's planting because the yields might be low, but the flavor is out of control. Whereas, you know, industrial farms are looking for something that's going to be more efficient. They're looking for something that's going to be uniform. They're looking for something with durability that's going to ship, that, you know, you can throw in a truck. And it's incredible, you know. I mean, you see trucks rolling on the freeway, and they're, you know, going 1,500 to 2,000 miles with produce from California to get to the other side of the country. And it's bouncing, and yet it still gets there in good enough shape that it's worth selling.
Yeah,
a good ripe peach couldn't do that. A good ripe fig couldn't do that.
You know, we talk about earlier in the show. We were talking about, you know, a store that sells all different kinds of products. You shouldn't be able to sell a baseball and a tomato as the actual same thing.
Yeah,
that shouldn't be the same exact product.
You know, Barry Esterbrook, who wrote Tomatoland, I'm sure you guys are familiar with him.
Sure.
He actually did a class while he was on tour at 18 Reasons at our education space. And he had never been to Bi-Rate, and he came in to Bi-Rate looking for a gassed Florida tomato. And, of course, we don't sell them. We haven't sold them for years. And went somewhere else to find it. And during this class, he actually took this tomato and threw it against the wall and then rolled it on the ground and then picked it up and then passed it around to everybody. And this thing was like a baseball.
Yeah.
No damage, no crack, no dent. It was unbelievable, you know. And this is like 90% of the tomatoes that we eat.
Yeah, that's terrible. Why they taste like cardboard. Why don't you explain to folks what do you mean by a gassed tomato? I think a lot of our listeners know, but some may not.
So, a lot of tomatoes, or most tomatoes, are harvested really early. They're harvested when they're green, so that way they're still firm enough to transport, have a longer shelf life, and then they're put in storage facilities and gassed with ethylene, and ethylene just pops the color and brightens them up, and it's and there's nothing artificial about it. It's all natural, but it's not.
But they still taste like cardboard.
In the sense that it's ripening. Naturally,
right. Well, just turning it red does not make it ripen. And actually,
that's right.
they
it doesn't
sell
make it taste any, like anything other than a hard tomato.
And that's why you often heard if you get an unripe peach, if you put it in a paper bag, it ripens more quickly. That's because that paper bag produce actually gives off ethylene gas.
That's right.
Over time, and so what you're doing by putting that peach in a paper bag is you're trapping the ethylene gas in the bags to accelerate the ripening or the softening, at least, of the peach. Not really the ripening of the peach.
Right. But there's nothing compares to something that's actually allowed to tree ripen.
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Nothing.
I'd like to talk about, and I want to get to your book in a second because it's really a great book, and I want our listeners to know about the book and have a chance to maybe snap it up for the holidays even. Who knows? But there's something that a lot of folks don't realize about the grocery business, and it's really pervasive. I mean, there was a statistic that I saw that said, when you go into your average supermarket, it's the illusion of choice, but 90% of the SKUs of the food in that store is owned by six parent companies. I mean, they're all different. They're companies that are owned by companies.
I think it was actually more than 90%.
Well, and so you have
depending on the industry.
You have the illusion of choice there. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that people don't realize is that at most large stores, if you come up with a good ravioli, then you want to sell it in the frozen food section of your local store. Or you come up with a great jarred sauce that you manufacture, and it's safe by USDA standards. Most stores will not sell your product, not only because it's a central decision making for the store's chain, but they also have slotting fees. I'm assuming that you don't have slotting fees.
No.
So, can you tell us about what slotting fees are and why it's so important that you don't have them?
Yeah, and this is kind of like one of the screwiest things about the whole industry. The supermarkets are, in my opinion, are just the agents, the sales agents for the food conglomerates, the Krafts and the General Mills of the world. So the large multinational corporations are able to turn tax dollars through purchasing of cheap and expensive commodity crops into packaged food that they can turn around at a fairly high margin, and then sell them to the supermarkets. There's 10 grocery store chains in the country are responsible for, I think it's like 74-75% of the food that we buy, that Americans buy. 10 companies. It's pretty incredible that it's in the hands of such a small amount of people.
It's incredible.
And it is incredible. And
I'm going to go with bad. I'm also going to say bad.
It's incredible and bad. Yeah, I'm with them.
It downright sucks.
Yeah.
because we are given this illusion of choice, and they're basically all competing to sell the same product, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they've all got the same mix of items in their stores. They're almost all merchandised in the same manner because these multinational corporations are paying a fee to position their product on the shelf in a certain place. And so they'll have a certain ad campaign for, let's say, Fruit Loops, and so nickel up and say, we want Fruit Loops, we want like 8 facings of Fruit Loops, we want it in the center of the cereal aisle, and we want it at aisle level. And so they'll pay for that position. They'll pay for ads in the aisles on the floor. They'll pay for ads on the shopping carts. They'll pay for ads in the circulars that the actual stores put out.
And so
all of that's paid for by the corporation.
And so Mrs. Smith, who comes up with a wonderful dried pasta.
Mrs. Smith, probably a bad example.
Yeah, that's right. I was talking. I think you're talking about apple pie. But, you know, Mrs. Jones, let's say, comes up with a great dried pasta. She's not getting in the store.
Well, if she does, she's going to get put on the bottom shelf, you know, with one facing and really in unfair pricing. You know, they'll position it at a much higher margin because they figure if somebody wants to buy that, they're going to pay for it. And so it's not the best place to buy unique items like that. You know, the marketers are brilliant. You know, they create, you know, in addition to these illusions of choice, they create these illusions of lush green pasture and beautiful farmland. You know, the cows and the pigs are on these grassy fields, and they're far from it. They're coming out of these confinement factory farms.
Yeah,
know,
I think
they're treated horribly.
Yeah, I think that if you put a picture of a pig or any sort of an animal on the food container, there should be a law that it has to be an actual example of the kind of pigs that you use. They'd sell nothing, you know. So tell us about what's in your store and how you source your items and how big it is. Can someone and what position you hope for it to play in the community?
Yeah, let's go ahead. I love talking about that. You know, I mean, our store's tiny. You know, our footprint's 2,700 square feet, and that's maybe less like 5% of the typical supermarket, 5% of the typical 50,000 square foot supermarket.
For those of you who know Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, each of those is about 2,700 square feet. So same size as each of our restaurants.
Yeah.
Cool.
The whole market.
So there you go. So there's a good relationship there spatially, but it's packed and it's got almost everything that you want to make a meal or you know even basic needs. I mean, we sell toilet paper and some cleaning supplies as well, wine, beer, spirits, but our main focus is food and it's like I was saying earlier, it's a cook store, you know, and it's a space where you can be inspired by the amazing displays and the amazing service that our staff provides. You know, we, in this tiny space, we've got about 100 employees, slightly over that now. 14 years ago, we started with 6, so it gives you a sense of how much growth we've gone, and. Do an amazing bang up business. I mean, it's a busy little store. It's the block that we came on. You know, my family's been on since 1964, so we're coming on our 50th year. Really didn't have very many active businesses. There was a restaurant on one corner and a bakery that had been around for a long time, and a few other commercial storefronts that were selling cookware and little junk shops kind of thing, a plant rental shop. A realty office, and in those 14 years, all these storefronts have converted and changed, and on one single block there was about 35 jobs when we took over. Now there's over 450 jobs on the street, and it's something that I'm proud of, and that's like what a community grocery store should be. It should be an anchor. It should be a magnet. It should help identify a neighborhood, and then be a partner with. Not only the people that support it, but the other businesses that want to feed off of it, and so we've created this amazing synergy with many businesses and with our community, with our neighbors, with the nonprofits that are in the area, with the schools.
Well, you know, would
you like to open in New Brunswick?
Yeah,
you know, one of the things that we hear all the time when we read the papers is we hear how. The provider of jobs and the jobs that are going to lead the any recovery if it ever happens
come from big business
is going to come from small business.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry, I hear all the time people big business telling me that it's coming from big business, but most of the economists or anybody that you talk to, you know, who really knows that the engine is small business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the number
over half is coming from small business right now.
Sure. Well, and you know, if you've got one guy moving millions of dollars worth of paper around. You make a lot of profit off that one guy, and you don't need a lot of people to do it. If you got to stock the shelves and sell the stuff for 79 cents a piece, man, it takes a lot of people to do that, and right. and that's a good thing. And that's a good thing, you know?
Right.
Hey,
right.
we'll be back in just a moment with Sam McGannum. We're going to talk when we come back, Sam, about your book, Eat Good Food. It's a collection of shopping guide and cookbook, and you can find out more about it in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome back to The Restaurant Guys. And we're talking with Sam McGannum. He owns the Byright Market in San Francisco. And we have yet to talk about your new book, Sam. Why does a grocer need to write a book?
Because we buy most of our food from grocery stores, and grocery stores don't put any effort into teaching people how to actually shop. And I felt compelled, you know, to provide some really good, solid, basic information to the general consumer around the country to empower them to make better decisions every time they go into the grocery store so they can actually eat better and eat healthier.
And these rules apply.
And,
rules apply even if they're not in your store.
Oh, yeah.
So
I mean, these are great questions that you can take anywhere you go. And, you know, the book is so much more than just a shopping guide. It's also a cookbook. There's over 90 recipes, and there we were really conscious of making sure that all the ingredients were accessible no matter where you were in the country. And if there was anything that was questionable, we offered a substitution for it. The recipes are seasonally driven and organized. So you can kind of flip through certain sections and say, hey, it's wintertime, what am I going to make?
Mark and I love the book, and I think it's a really useful guide to have on the shelf. And, you know, one of the things I think that people find a little bit daunting if you don't cook every day is you're having a party, you're having people over, you're going to make dinner. And for a lot of folks, you know, that starts with the trip to the grocery store. And how many times do you... you go to the store and you're not quite sure of everything you need. You know, it's sort of like a military planning operation. Whereas I think for a one-off battle, you know, I mean, I think with this book you can more win the war. What kind of advice do you give people in the book about shopping in general?
A lot. I mean, I think the first key point of advice is to just, you know, build a relationship with the person you're buying your food from. If you have a good relationship with that person, then a lot of the mystery gets taken out of it because you can actually feel comfortable asking them questions.
Well, I find that's really when people buy, especially when people are buying fresh vegetables and meat and fish, you can't really feel ignorant about going to ask how do I cook this? Where does this come from? What should it be like? You know, and where did it come from? You know, I mean, I think people are very reticent about fresh herbs, fresh produce, meat. It can be a little daunting, you know, when you look at produce, if you're at a great market, and say, what is that? How do I cook that? Do I use the seeds? Well, you know, how does that work?
Right. And unfortunately, part of the problem is that there's rarely any staff around. You know, people just, you know, most supermarkets will just throw a bunch of stuff on the shelf and then walk away from it and not be there to support the staff because they don't want to pay for that labor. And I encourage you to, you know, go somewhere where there actually is somebody you can talk to. Farmers markets, which are popping up all around the country, are a great place to begin to develop a relationship with somebody who really cares about the food that they're selling because they've grown it. And so you learn a little couple things from there, and then you take that little bit and apply it to the supermarket. You know, you read my book, you know, Eat Good Food is just packed with information. And, you know, basically we walk you through each key department in the grocery store, from the grocery section to the produce, dairy, meat, fish, wine, cheese, bread, so that you know what to look for, you know what questions to ask. And then when you ask that question and you don't get the answer that you want or an answer that's clear, then I encourage you to say no. Because right. if you say no and enough people say no enough times, that market is going to change the products that they bring in, because you know what? They're there to sell food. They're there to make money and conduct business. And if people are walking and going somewhere else, they're going to bring that product in. I promise you. Mm-hmm. I've seen it happen here. I've seen it happen in many places.
But, you know, the little stores like yours, though, I feel like they're few and far between, and you know, maybe even more so than they used to be. You know, those little... The little proprietarily owned markets, you know, with the exception of the farmers market, which I agree have got a real stronghold again and are growing by the day. I just don't see enough stores like this for people to make their choice.
It's interesting you say that, because right now I feel there's almost like this resurgence of mm-hmm. small stores. They're starting to pop up everywhere. I mean, you know, you see them all over Manhattan and Brooklyn now. Parts of Queens, you know, San Francisco, the Bay Area, they're popping up. I know in Chicago, there's a few markets. And L.A., they're popping up. Seattle, Portland are having them. And, you know, people want to support the local community.
I agree.
You know, they're just not sure exactly how. And unfortunately, a lot of those businesses closed, you know, and our priorities shifted, and that kind of helped facilitate the closure of a lot of these small corner markets, and they all, you know, relegated to selling the same things. You know, they're selling, you know, Doritos and Twinkies and cigarettes and mm-hmm. malt liquor, and you know, maybe you might find a banana every once in a while, you know, but it probably is overripe. But they want it. They want to be able to, like, walk out of their house, walk down to the corner, and like, have a relationship with this dude that's going to feed them. And so communities can do that. They can empower, they can encourage, and if somebody does try to do it, just get out there and support the hell out of them, because they need it, you know?
Well, because it's harder for them. They don't have a multinational corporation behind them. Right. You know, I think
the hardest part is the price. You know, the thing that I get hit on more than anything else is, you know, we're expensive, and you know, and it's a struggle, because you know the our suppliers are making, you know, a 20 plus point margin on us, whereas you know the supermarkets, they're getting cost plus 6, 7, 8%, and so the spread, you know, we're already dealing with a 15% spread on our costs, and so that's going to be reflected on the shelves, and so we have to work harder to provide a better product, a more unique product, and better service.
Plus, there's no government subsidizing your ingredients.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's a big part of the cost. Right. But I just think it's ironic that what we're really describing here, and what your store has, from what I see, seems to evolved from, is that kind of country store, that store that. In the 30s, 40s, 50s, you would go to where everybody knew everybody, and you know, there would be fresh, interesting products on the shelves. And what you're saying and what I've seen is those country stores seem to be reestablishing themselves in the cities first.
Yeah. I think you have the density in the cities mm-hmm. to support these things. I think in the suburbs, where you know you have to drive somewhere, it's much harder. And when we do see a bit of we certainly have no food deserts out here. We have a lot of supermarkets, and you see some larger chains like Whole Foods that are right. starting to cater in this direction. But as far as the little stores, I think that those are mostly in the cities now. Do you think so?
Yeah, they are, and that, you know, and that's where really most you know, revolutions and trends start. I hope that it'll begin to spread to the rural suburban areas. You know, but one of the biggest challenges is Walmart. You know, I was reading that there was this great infographic that came out I don't know, like a week or two ago, and they were just talking about how many Walmarts there are, and you know, 60% of the U.S. population lives within 5 miles of a Walmart. 96% live within 20 miles.
My God.
So if you think about that, right? I mean, that's where most of rural America is shopping.
Yeah.
And and there isn't much choice there, you know. And Walmart is, you know, selling in addition to food. I mean, they're a ton of other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just about moving product. You know, and they're in my opinion depleting their communities. They're taking away any diversity in their communities. They're controlling the flow of food, not just through themselves, but through everybody. I mean, there's such a behemoth that they're influencing the entire food chain.
You know,
and
well,
we
you know,
need
it's
to take control of it back. You know, I mean, it's a basic need that should be in our hands, not in the hands of an organization that's publicly held.
Well, you talked about choice, and what people don't realize is when they go to Walmart to shop for price, or some of these other big supermarkets, they're eliminating their choices.
Well, and people make, I think it's a specious argument. It's a flawed argument, at least. That people say, well, if people didn't want Walmart, then there wouldn't be a Walmart because people wouldn't shop there. Except right. that Walmart can come in, and you know, this is why we have antitrust laws that are obviously, I don't know why they're not. Our antitrust laws should be a little more, have some more teeth to them, because Walmart moves into a community, and the local butcher, the local florist, the local grocer, the local bookstore, the local record store, the local
shop, right?
they all go out of business, and right. then you're left with Walmart. And right. you know, you're talking about a person who's maybe challenged for funds to put enough food on the table, and they open the Walmart, and it's cheaper, and Walmart has the ability to come in even cheaper until they put everybody else out of business, and then they can comfortably raise their prices a little
right.
bit.
Right.
And you say, okay, this working-class person, Walmart has done them a great favor because they can save them 10% on their grocery bills, except the downtown that they lived in is all shut down. Walmart right. is the only place they can go, and Walmart's free to raise prices a little bit once they put everybody else out of business. That is yeah. not, you know, that argument makes me angry.
It makes me angry too, because all those people who now have to go to Walmart because it's cheapest were the ones that lost their jobs
yeah,
when, they,
right, exactly.
when they came in and shut everybody down, you know? I mean, the whole thing is so screwed up.
I know, it's crazy. Well,
yeah,
and
it's wild, man.
And Walmart has, what, 1% of the gross domestic product of the United States because it goes through Walmart?
Something egregious like
okay,
that.
Okay, if that doesn't...
$421 billion, you know, I mean, that's so I don't even know. It's the 25th largest economy in the world. It's crazy.
And if that doesn't set off the antitrust bells, then our antitrust bells are broken. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, AMP, you know, which is a huge, you know, huge East Coast chain. It was like an, I don't know, it must have been like 40, at least 40 states. The antitrust folks went after them.
And, when was that?
Oh God, I think it was like in the 50s. And they were definitely much smaller than Walmart was, you know. So I don't know why you know somebody hasn't really kind of tried to take them down, though they're just so powerful and they wield so much influence and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
It's really unfortunate.
You know, I want to move away from politics for a little while
because
I'm sure that 20% of our listeners are like, would they stop already?
yeah.
But I do have to ask you something, because I have a number of friends who are doing this now, and you've kind of spun off a couple of different businesses and a little farm and you're doing some
creamery.
Yeah.
But the one I want to ask you about is beekeeping, because
yeah,
it
sure.
seems like cities around the world, people from all over the place are now, you know, beekeeping.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that process, how you get started and why someone wants to keep a gazillion bees, 60,000 bees, are buzzing around
yeah,
his house?
They're amazing. The colonies are huge. You know, they're so beautiful. You know, we put our first hives up on the roof at the store, right? You know, right smack in the middle of the city, about 5 years ago. And we found a local beekeeper who was selling us honey, you know, from hives in the neighborhood. And we started, you know, we like most of our suppliers, we become close to them and develop relationships. And I was like, dude, can we throw some hives up on the roof? I'd love to have honey up there, you know, honey that we can use for our ice cream. And he was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. So he went up and he took a look. He walked around our block and it's like, you know, this is a great block. There's a lot of, you know, great, you know, we're in a banana belt in San Francisco. So it's always, you know, generally sunny. We started with two hives. You know, he named the queens after my daughters, Zoe and Olive. You know, we're up to three hives now and about to add two, maybe three more in the next few weeks. We need bees, you know, bees pollinate.
Yeah.
they keep plants alive and thriving and provide us with an amazing nectar that can do, you know, it's just so great for us. You know, so many of our guests that live in the neighborhood come and buy the rooftop honey because it's amazing for allergy.
How much
suppression?
How much honey does a hive produce for you?
Every year is different. You know, generally we get two to three harvests out of a hive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a decent harvest, we'll get 60 to 100 pounds out of a hive.
That's groovy, man.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You know, we've had, you know, as low as 30, 40 pounds. You know, we've also had, you know, a colony collapse. You know, we had one of our queens died, and we lost one of the colonies, which was a bummer. But
and it's a pretty big problem right now that you know, you can go back in our archives and we can talk about colony collapse disorder. You can look back. Francis and I have done a couple shows on.
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, I mean, there's just so many more pollutants out in the world. You know, and they're getting impacted by it.
So, what is there anything that's a nuisance to keeping bees around? Are your neighbors going to complain that you have bees around? What is there a downside at all to beekeeping?
You know, we haven't had one yet. You know, we had a refrigeration technician who, you know, our refrigeration compressor was up on the roof, and he was up there working on one of them, and he got stung. And then got stung again, and he was freaked out by it. But other than that, it's been smooth. You know, it was only one really weird time where we had a swarm right outside the market, and everyone thought it was from our hives, and it wasn't. And our beekeeper came down, and it was like, oh, cool, another swarm that I could scoop up. And so he lured them, you know, with a little lemongrass oil into a box.
That's
into
awesome.
A shoebox, and we captured that colony, and got free bees. It was cool.
All right, so explain how this works. So when a swarm is like when a colony goes and looks to start a new colony, when a colony breaks off of another colony, is that what that is?
That's right. You know, I mean, what'll end up happening is the colony might get a little bit too big. Or the queen might, you know, if the queen dies, then the colony really doesn't know what to do, and so they take off and they look for a new home. They look for somewhere else where they can actually establish a hive. Typically, they would just, you know, form their own hive and do it in the wild, and then lay a new queen and start over. And so, you know, beekeepers are looking. You know, most beekeepers keep the tools they need. You know, the box and some sort of scent to lure them. With them wherever they go. The other beekeeper that we work with up in Sonoma, he captures swarms all the time. It's pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool stuff. So when you call the beekeeper or when you call for help when you have a swarm of bees because you want them away from you, the beekeeper actually
he's the Pied Piper of bees.
Awesome.
He is the Pied Piper. You know, and it's cool. And it's just like that's nature working itself. You know,
wow.
And taking care of itself.
Hey.
Powerful.
Listen, man, what you do out there, the work that you do out there sounds really great, and the book is also a lot of fun and really useful for people. So if people want to find out more about Buy Right Markets, Eat Good Food, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll put up a link and tell you all about it, and you can find out where to buy it, and it's a terrific terrific contribution.
Thanks, Sam.
Cool. Yeah, man. You guys can also follow us on Twitter. We're at BuyRightSF, BIRITESF.
All right, man.
That's awesome.
We'll put that up there on the web as well if you forget it. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. You know what I wanted to say before we lost Sam? I'm glad that you derailed us to the honey conversation. First of all, I think honey's amazing. Secondly, it's at the center of a lot of controversy swirling around honey with colony collapse disorder out
buzzing
there.
Buzzing around honey, even.
and then also you've seen all these reports of tainted counterfeit honey.
Oh, the counterfeit honey
labeled
China.
From other places.
Yeah, that's bad.
But it's really Chinese honey, which is full.
No,
of...
No, not just Chinese honey. It's really Chinese sugar that's been blended with honey.
Right, and the honey itself is often from tainted areas that have all kinds of bad things in them.
Oh.
So if you want to be sure where your honey's coming from, if there's a hive on the roof.
Rooftop honey. Buy rooftop honey.
I've always wanted to have a beehive. I think it'd be really, really cool to have a hive in the backyard.
Maybe this is the dawn of a new idea.
Francis and Mark's Restaurant Guys Honey.
Restaurant Guys Honey, the roof of Stage Left.
Interesting. I think in the roof of my suburban backyard, or in the suburban backyard of my home would be probably.
I don't know. Might be more fun to do it here.
Yeah? Maybe. Maybe, but you know, I'm afraid.
I'm afraid too. I got to tell you, he's talked about the swarm in front of the store. We have an outdoor cafe that operates about, you know, during the months that the bees would be active, and I just see the panic of the swarm of bees coming down. And
is it long enough ago that we can talk about the wasp issue we had?
Oh, sure. It was the early 90s.
We had the Sidewalk Cafe that we put out when we first opened in 92, and then maybe 93, and that was very successful. It's our lifeblood in the summertime. And then in the summer, in this next summer, our patrons started getting attacked by wasps.
What? Not lovely little honeybees that ever sting you.
These were the wasps that wanted your hamburger.
These are the wasps that eat meat.
And,
exactly.
And if you tried to dissuade the wasps from getting your hamburger, they'd settle for you. And as you might imagine, this was not awesome for business. So we called in the beekeeper, and pest guy, I don't know, and he's like, "Oh yeah, those are
he's a bee guy. Bees R Us
right, yeah, that's good. Very memorable name.
There's a plug for Bees R Us guy.
So he comes, he says, "Yeah, if they were bees, I could do something about it." I was like, "What do you mean?" "Well, these are wasps." Okay, so where's the wasp nest? Oh, somewhere within a mile. What?
Could be mile away.
And these wasps are burrowing wasps. It's probably just a little hole in the ground. You wouldn't see it anyway. So why are they coming here? And they like the food.
You have food, exactly.
We'd bring out aromatic burgers, and then once they find that you're a hot spot for food, and so it was just hard. When they would always come as the sun went down, just as people were getting their entrees, and so finally we just put an all-out war on the wasps that summer, and we put traps everywhere in a perimeter around the restaurant.
Do you remember what works?
Hanging from the trees.
Do you remember what works best in those traps?
What's that?
Shrimp.
Oh,
We used to put shrimp in the traps. And so we'd have these little wasp catchers with shrimp in them hanging from the tree.
30
in the
of them.
Cafe. It was 30 really,
of them.
Really ridiculous.
And I believe we finally collapsed that colony, or just the ones that came to New Brunswick stopped returning, and that was the end of it. But that was a hard summer, man.
Oh, it was brutal.
Seeing your customers, imagine this, you own a restaurant, you look out the window, you see your lovely cafe, you turn around, you look out again, and your patrons are all running around swatting things.
Yeah, swatting over their heads,
running
ducking
in
for cover.
It's bad. But you know, the one thing I was going to say about honey is, and I think I've said this on the show before, you know, honey is one of the two perfect foods. It's one of the two things, it's one of the only two things that are created as food are milk and honey. And they go back to the Bible. Isn't that profound?
And honey doesn't go bad.
We are just chock full of information on honey, are we not?
There we are. I've used it all up, though. I have no more honey information.
There is edible honey that they have recovered from the tombs of Egyptian kings inside the pyramids. Okay. All right. Well, now I'm out of useless information about honey, so I think we should end the show. What do you think?
I'm in.
All right. I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.